The Basics of Genetics, Lecture 13. Viruses, Jumping Genes, and Symbionts. Whose DNA is it, and what are the new philosophical questions?
One of the really profound questions that has come out of the completion of the human genome, and in fact the completion of many more human genomes since then, is whose DNA is this? And that might seem like a surprising question. Whose DNA could it possibly be? It's the DNA of a human. But it turns out to be relevant. The more we understand about what we consider to be our DNA, the more we realize that much of it is not our DNA in the sense that we've traditionally thought of it that way. And in fact, it was said recently that the new philosophical question really should be not who am I, but who are we? And let me tell you what is meant by that and develop that in this lecture. First of all, I need you to envision a cell. And we actually haven't done much with envisioning a cell in this course. Genetics is so much about the information and how that information is used that we really haven't done much with envisioning a cell. So let me walk you through that a little bit and introduce you to the idea that we may have much more DNA than what we've actually been talking about in our cells. A cell is a complex membrane-bound container for all of our chemical reactions and all of the structures that are going to facilitate those chemical reactions. I hesitate to say it's a bag of chemical reactions because it's so much more complicated and intricate than that. But if you want to, for this purpose, to imagine it as a bag of complicated chemical reactions, that's fine. Let's look inside of the cell. Inside of the cell, we have all kinds of sub-compartments by which the cell even further organizes things so that some compartments are specialized for some particular functions and some compartments for others. It makes a lot of sense. If you are trying to organize tens of thousands of different things, you might start to use little compartments. One type of compartment we have is called the mitochondria. And on average, let's say each of our cells has about 100 mitochondria. Now, mitochondria are where energy is being processed. The energy that will keep our cells going, the energy that keeps us going as entire organisms, absolutely crucial way that energy is processed, and it's happening in these little mitochondria. We have about 100 of them per cell, plus or minus. Different cells have slightly different numbers. And if you want a sort of analogy for these, it's almost like the boiler room or the furnace room. It's very important. Nothing happens without the proper functioning of the boiler room or the furnace room. Nothing happens without the proper use of energy and transformation of energy in the cell. In the cookie factory, this is the energy plant that's powering the whole thing. So it's so profoundly important that it gets taken for granted. Okay, the more important something is in a cell, and the more it's just functioning along as it should, the more you can get away with ignoring it. But we're not going to ignore it right now. We're going to acknowledge that we've got these very important little boiler rooms or furnace rooms throughout the cell, providing all of the energy for everything else that we've been talking about. Now, it turns out that mitochondria originated 2.5 billion years ago, a long time ago, as free-living bacteria, which got into symbiotic relationships with our cells. So what those little mitochondria are bacteria that are now absolutely intimate and completely integrated with our cells to the point where if you took a look at them, you wouldn't necessarily say, oh, look at all the bacteria. They look like mitochondria and they're acting like mitochondria, but their origin is they were once separate bacteria. And this is 2.5 billion years ago. So we've had a long, long time with an intimate relationship with these little mitochondria, former bacteria. But what it means is each little mitochondrion, that's the singular, each little mitochondrion has its own DNA. Now, not very much of it because bacterial DNA, there's usually considerably less of it, and these have even less than typical bacteria because they've had such a long intimate relationship with us. But each mitochondria has about 10 copies of about 20,000 A's, C's, G's, and T's. And if we have about 100 of these little mitochondria, it means that we have 20 million A's, C's, G's, and T's that are from these bacterial symbionts. 20 million of our bases, of our A's, C's, G's, and T's, are not ours at all. They belong to the original bacterial symbionts that are doing this extremely important function of essentially maintaining the energy levels of the cell that we need in order to be able to function. So that's 20 million bases. Remember, we have 6 billion. We actually have 3 billion unique sequences of A, C, G, and T. But remember, we've got two copies. We've got one copy from our mother, one copy from our father. So a total of 6 billion, just to give you these numbers in perspective. But recall what I told you about what part of our 6 billion bases is actually coding for genes. It's less than 10%. And then some small amount more is understood to be the grammar of the gene use, which is beginning to be unfolded, and we'll know more and more about that as years go by. But what about the rest of our genome? What about the rest of our 6 billion bases? Is that ours? It turns out that it might not be. About 5/6 of our genome, 5/6 of our genome is either virus or virus-like. And I'm not going to make too big a distinction between virus and virus-like, or viral and viral-like, except to say that as we look through the human genome, and as we look through any genome, base by base, A, C, G, T, reading them off and trying to understand them, more and more there is a realization that most of our DNA is not technically ours. It's viral DNA. What does that mean, 5/6 of our genome? Well, if we have 3 billion bases of information, it means 2.7 billion of those are viral. So that's a pretty important observation, and one that really throws a wrench into the works of our former understanding of what a virus is. In fact, it completely transforms what we're thinking now about viruses, or what people who are looking at genomes are thinking about viruses. Some of the things are perhaps obvious. If we are filled with viral genomes or virus-like genomes, and we're not all sick, then I guess most viruses must not be pathogenic. And that's a fairly profound thought, because the history of virology has been intimately connected with pathogenicity. Of necessity, it's very difficult to see viruses. And until we completed the Human Genome Project and the other genome projects, we weren't really aware of just the number of virus and virus-like entities that we were carrying around. Viruses typically have been looked at for whatever damage they're doing. In other words, we don't notice them if they're not doing damage. So they tended to be defined by what they caused. HIV, measles, mumps, rabies, and then completely ignored when they weren't doing anything at all. It looks like perhaps the vast majority of what we think of as viruses are far from being pathogenic. And actually, when you stop and think about it, it's fairly difficult to be a pathogen. It's much easier to be benign, to just be a quiet bit of DNA in the genome, being replicated along with all of the other DNA. In a sense, it seems rational to finally think about viruses this way. The life of a pathogen is a challenging one. They've got to get from host to host. They've got to bypass the host immune system somehow, and there are all sorts of mechanisms for that. They've got to get themselves ensconced in a new cell inside of the host, and then they've got to have some particular function that they manage to maintain. And the whole thing is just a whole lot more work, a whole lot more complicated than just simply quietly being in the genome. So it might be just as simple as that. Now, what about pictures that you've seen of viruses? One thing you should know about this is, because humans are highly visual organisms, we tend to gravitate to pictures. The pictures of viruses that you might be familiar with, or that you could easily find, tend to give us the impression that we must be looking at a typical virus that has a beautiful, elaborate, geometric-like protein coat protecting its DNA and by which it can travel around from one person to another. The cold virus, the common cold virus that people unfortunately pass around, or the flu virus that people get every year, has a beautiful little protein. They have beautiful little protein coats by which they can travel from one person to another. And we start to equate having that beautiful protein coat with being a virus. Again, that's the pathogens. The vast majority of viruses, the ones that are ensconced in our genome permanently or nearly permanently, have lost their ability or perhaps never even had the ability to ever make a protein coat. So at no point are they getting up and leaving and going off wearing a beautiful protein coat. So that's another misconception about viruses. Not only then are they not all pathogenic, but most of them are very, very simple. They're really just information. They're just little bits of information, distinctively coded so that we can spot them, but really not doing much of anything except for taking up most of our genome. Remember the packaging problem we were talking about when we talked about mitosis and meiosis, and what a major thing it was for the cell to sort all of that DNA into two separate cells, which we need to do when we do mitosis and meiosis, and how it needs to be packaged up into chromosomes and how those need to be sorted out. Now we have kind of a funny image. We're spending a great deal of time packaging up and sorting out essentially somebody else's DNA, viral DNA. And we're doing it very efficiently, and we're passing that DNA on to the next generation, and it's doing just fine. But it really gives a new look at what is going on with viruses. By the way, let me digress a little bit on the flu virus, which is always of concern to people, especially in the winter season. It's characteristic of a couple of things that are about those few viruses that are pathogens. The ones that are pathogens are the ones that tend to have a brand new relationship with us, and even a brand new relationship within itself. Now, what am I talking about? Well, the flu virus tends to originate in other animals, chickens, pigs, are the two major examples, other sorts of birds besides chickens as well. But it tends to be chickens because they tend to be farmed or domesticated animals that are kept in large numbers and have lots of interactions with each other. So viruses or parts of viruses from chickens or birds, viruses or parts of viruses from pigs come together and make a new form of virus, little recombination. So it's new within itself. It's a new combination. And then, in some cases, that new little virus can get into humans where it has a brand new relationship with a brand new host. And those are some of the more dangerous viruses. That's actually characteristic of pathogenicity in a virus. The newness of the relationship within itself because of strange little recombinations like that, and the newness as it arrives into a host and is out of synchrony with what that host is about, out of synchrony with the way that host is dividing itself and maintaining itself. So it's a rare phenomenon, but when it does happen, I think it's important to understand it as a deviation from really the normal situation that viruses are in. One of the things that I've tried to do throughout these lectures is to try to take even challenging concepts and ideas and bring them around somehow to things that we can observe ourselves, things that I can observe myself, and things that I'd like to introduce you to thinking about. And so possibly you were wondering, is there anything that we can do to catch a glimpse of our own enormous set of virus and virus-like information, essentially viruses or DNA information? Is there anything we can catch a glimpse of these? And the answer is going to be yes, and I'm going to give you some absolutely marvelous examples that will delight you. But before I do that, let me clarify a little bit why I'm being so cagey about talking about viruses and virus-like information, and what do I mean by that? Well, it turns out that there are two major sorts of virus or virus-like information in our DNA. One is viral, and the other is something called jumping genes. These are genes that can move around from one place to the other in the genome, which is a really disconcerting thought, but think about it anyway. Furthermore, many viruses can jump around like this. Or none of the above. It's completely possible to find something that used to be a jumping gene, which can no longer jump around, or a virus that used to move around in the genome, which can no longer move around, but nonetheless be aware that that was at one point their capability. But the image I want you to have is something that can move around in the genome. And the original discovery of jumping genes was in the 1940s by Barbara McClintock, who was doing corn genetics and closely examining the equivalent of the ornamental corn that you can buy in a grocery store. And I've already suggested strongly that you get some ornamental corn when it's in season and really take a look at the beautiful colors and even see if you can see some ratios of that would be Mendelian ratios. But what Barbara McClintock did in the 1940s is she was closely examining corn color genetics and came across some peculiar kernels of corn that, instead of being solidly colored yellow or white or purple or red, were in spots, spots of white on color or spots of color on a white background. You can see this too, actually, if you look carefully. If you look through a great deal of corn, you may find on one ear one or two kernels that look a little bit strange. If you see any speckled kernels at all, you are probably catching a glimpse of the activities of jumping genes, because what seems to be going on with those is in those particular kernels, a jumping gene has jumped into the middle of a gene that makes color, but then occasionally jumps out. So when it's in the gene, when the jumping gene is inside the color gene, has jumped into place, it prevents color. And when it jumps out, it allows that color gene to produce color again. And so you get alternating speckles and mottled color and no color in that one kernel. It's a fairly rare occurrence, so I'm not saying you can find this in every ear of corn that you look at. But if you're interested in trying to catch a glimpse of what Barbara McClintock saw, it can be done. I do have examples of it that I've found in grocery stores that I recognize as jumping genes in action, changing the color. I have some other plant examples for you. It turns out that plants are especially good examples, and that's where I want to take you to really get a visualization of this. Plants are especially tolerant of having jumping genes and viruses moving around and affecting their genetics. So let me give you a couple of other examples that I think you'll enjoy. This one may take you to an art museum. This one takes us to 17th century Holland, where people were doing beautiful paintings of all sorts of floral arrangements, and tulips are very often the subject of those paintings of floral arrangements. So you're going to the 17th century Netherlands section of the museum to look at beautiful tulips, and noticing that in many cases, the tulips that were being painted, the tulips that clearly were highly prized by 17th century Dutch painters, were ones in which the colors look all broken up and uneven, splotches of red and yellow against different backgrounds. Clearly something very exciting is going on with the genetics of this. And in fact, the phenomenon was called the breaking of colors, breaking colors in tulips. Turns out, and we don't know exactly which one it was, and it really doesn't matter too much which one it was either something viral or something like a jumping gene. And more people are realizing there's not much of a major difference between viruses and jumping genes. So I'm not too worried about which one it was, but it was one of these elements, one of these moving jumping elements, jumping in and out of the color genes of these tulips that was giving this amazing breaking colors phenomenon that was so popular. There's an entire movement in Holland at this time called tulipomania, in which people were very excited about getting the most exotic tulip colors they could possibly get. And the breaking colors tulips were high on the list of especially desirable tulips that people were spending enormous amounts of money on. Now, you can look through a bulb catalog today and go straight to the tulip section and look for the tulips that look like they have breaking colors, in other words, the ones that are not solid, the ones in which the coloring looks all irregular, and you will be catching a glimpse of this phenomenon. I will say, however, you probably won't see in the fine print describing the particular tulip that a virus or virus-like piece of DNA or a jumping gene is involved. That's probably not going to be part of the fine print. In general, it's not the sort of thing that advertises in a positive way tulips to the general public. Generally, people have a really negative feeling about viruses and other sorts of viral-like entities. But you will know what they are. Take a look at them, and you'll see that when you see really irregular coloration, you're looking at not the exact breaking color tulips of the 17th century. I don't think that strain is around any longer, but you'll be seeing some modern version of the breaking of colors in tulips. And it's why, by the way, if you get some of those tulips and plant them in their garden, the color is not stable. Whatever the breaking colors were doing in the first season, they'll be doing something a little bit different in the second season. And by the third season, you may not see as much of the color changes as you might expect it. So it's not considered to be a stable trait. And that you might find in the fine print. And I'm telling you this in case you want to pour through the rest of the catalog of plants to look for the indicator that the trait is not stable. And that's usually the euphemism for this particular phenomenon going on. Another thing you might want to do is get beyond the catalogs and get right to a store that sells plants or flowers and look for any wild-looking variegation that you can find. Last summer, I came across a geranium called the peppermint twist geranium. I'm mentioning only because it has a wonderful name, and many times these plants do have wonderful names. And as soon as I saw it, I knew that it was either jumping genes or viruses, and I didn't care which it was. I bought it, and I put it on my side porch. It's absolutely beautiful. So almost any kind of wild-looking variegation is a great candidate for you being able to talk about either viral or jumping gene-type DNA. There's another way to get plant variegations, wild, different splotches of color in plants or lack of color. And I want to tell you about it because it connects with some other things that we've been talking about, and it will give you a more complete picture of that, so you'll be able to talk about plant variegations more knowledgeably. Remember we talked about mitochondria as being of symbiotic origin, carrying their own little DNA and now being thoroughly integrated into our cells, but still making up a great part of the cellular DNA? Well, in plants, there's an additional little compartment that has to do with the processing of energy called the chloroplast. And it's green because of chlorophyll, and it's where plants process energy from the sun and turn it into the sort of energy that they can use to cause all of their various cell processes to occur. So it's just as important as the mitochondria, and it's a typically plant structure, the chloroplast. It, too, is of symbiotic origin. It, too, originated around 2.5 billion years ago as a free-living type of bacteria that were doing what plants do, photosynthesis, and which are now thoroughly integrated into all plants or most plants. And so in order to understand the other kind of variegation that I want to talk to you about, we need to think about chloroplasts. And we need to think about some of the logistics of sex again. Many, many times when organisms are sexually reproducing, the female sex cell is much bigger than the male sex cell. Most obvious example, the egg is much bigger than the sperm. The other example, and I'll go to plants now because this is going to be a plant example, the egg of a plant, or the ovum, sometimes called an ovum of a plant, is often much bigger than the pollen, and the pollen is the equivalent of the sperm of the plant. So what does this mean? Well, go back to the image that I tried to give you at the beginning of this lecture about the cell as a large compartment filled with all sorts of sub-levels of compartments in which all sorts of wonderful chemical reactions are going on and being coordinated, and that's your picture of the cell. Well, that cell could be an egg, it could be an ovum, And it's going to be the source, because of its sheer size, of whatever the future zygote, the new embryo, is going to have for all sorts of cell compartments and cell parts. Because the sperm, or the pollen, is very, very tiny, and it arrives with almost nothing but some DNA. Its major contribution is going to be some DNA, almost nothing else. And so most of the inner workings of the cell are going to be contributed by the mother in the particular mating. This is called maternal inheritance. So it's not maternal inheritance of the DNA in the nucleus. That's a collaboration between the sperm and the egg, a collaboration between the pollen and the ovum. But it's maternal inheritance of everything else, just because of the sheer size of the egg and the sheer tininess of the sperm. So that means that whatever mitochondria you have are your mother's. It means whatever chloroplasts a plant has, and this is true for many, many plants, there are some exceptions, but in many plants, whatever chloroplasts a plant has are its mother's. It's called maternal inheritance. Think about that for a minute. All of your mitochondria are your mother's. Your father's mitochondria were essentially a dead end. Your father's mitochondria did not get into the next generation. This means, in the case of the chloroplasts, that if there is a mutation in the DNA of the chloroplasts, it will be passed along to the offspring via the mother. If there's a mutation in the chloroplasts of the father, it will not be passed along at all. Some mutations in chloroplasts cause the chloroplast to be colorless. Okay, typically a chloroplast is green, and that's how come plants are green, and so that's where the green of plants is coming from, the chloroplast DNA that helps to make that color. In some cases, a chloroplast will have a mutation to its DNA that will render it colorless, and it's one of the other ways that you can get variegation in plants. It will typically, though, not be the kind of dramatic variegation that you get in flowers, where you have reds and blues and purples and yellows involved. It's going to be more like a variegation involving green versus white. So it's something else to watch for, and it's something else that you can hypothesize about if you spot a new variegated plant, especially if it's a green and white modeling. You can say you're not sure whether it's viruses and jumping genes or whether it's something to do with the inheritance of a mutated chloroplast from the maternal side of the plant's family. So what about your mitochondria that you inherited from your mother? Well, it's research on those mitochondria that has helped some people to figure out a little better the lineage of humans, and have helped to date back a little bit more accurately our origins in East Africa. I said it was about 200,000 years ago that humans as Homo sapiens began evolving in East Africa, and then from there began migrating out across Africa and across Europe and Asia and into the Americas. But tracing that poses all sorts of challenges, and one of the ways that this has been done is to look at mitochondrial DNA, because it's a little more straightforward than the nuclear DNA. Remember, the nuclear DNA, every single generation is going to get mixed up, male and female together, mixed up, so the next generation is going to have a sort of a new hybrid of whatever the parents contributed, whereas the mitochondrial DNA is going to be a little bit more of a pure lineage being passed down maternally. And so that's why the idea of mitochondrial DNA was and still is such a powerful way to think about human lineages. And it's one of the ways in which fairly directly and fairly accurately, we think, some dates could be applied to when humans really first started to originate. Does not mean, as some people think, that there was one woman back there who contributed all the mitochondrial DNA, appealing as a thought that might be, one original woman from whom all of the mitochondrial DNA is coming. But it does mean that there was probably a fairly small population of humans, and it's only women in that population that had any possibility of passing down their mitochondria. And it was probably a fairly closely related little group of humans, too. Humans, remember, for most of their history, tended to be living in small, interbreeding somewhat inbred little populations, little pockets, little islands. So it was probably a small band of humans with some fairly closely related women. And it's those mitochondria that were passed down and which now can be traced back to that original origin of Homo sapiens sapiens. Well, we have a lot to wrap up in this course, and that is what I will attempt to do in the next and final lecture for this series.
This ends Lecture 13.